Hello and welcome to the Old Man Sailing Podcast. I'm John Passmore and I'm speaking to you today from Aruba. And if I sound a little out of practice, there's a very good reason for it. I was sitting in the cockpit here, underneath my plastic tarpaulin awning, sheltering from the midday sun, and tapping away on my computer, when suddenly about 5 gallons of rainwater emptied itself out of the awning all over the laptop. And it had to go off for repair shortly before Hurricane Helene went and trashed the offices of the computer shop supplier in Florida. So it's all been rather a long time. Never mind. Let's get started with Old Men Use Spinnaker Squeezers. Years and years ago, I wrote a piece for Yachting World called Real Men Don't Use Spinnaker Squeezers. It centred around the mother of all brooches in Largo off the Grand Banks towards the end of the 1988 O-Star, which that year was sponsored by Carlsberg, although the beer has all gone by the time we left Plymouth. There were two particular features of this brooch which remain stuck fast in the memory. One was that it all happened in the middle of the night, and most inky black night it was, come to that, but the spinnaker sheet popped the life buoy out of its bracket, dragging the strobe light with it, which, of course, started flashing, lighting up the entire scene in a series of frozen images, the myriad droplets of Atlantic fixed in time and space. And while all this was going on, the cockpit speakers continued to play, relentlessly, Maurice Chevalier singing Thank Heaven for Little Girls. All of this comes to mind because I dared to suggest on a Facebook sailing group that traditional spinnakers, the symmetrical kind, were a lot more versatile than cruising chutes and asymmetric spinnakers. Back in 1988, the asymmetric version had only just been invented and was strictly the preserve of the racing sailor. The rest of us had the old-fashioned kind and pulled it out. Occasionally, it ended up in the water. That was the way it was. We thought nothing of it. Yet now, people seem to be horrified at the idea of flying a traditional spinnaker. Samsara came with a cruising chute. I swapped it for what I would call a proper one, with the man who had never taken it out of his attic and had been warned by the previous owner that it was a monster. No, it isn't. It's a pussycat. Pussycat with a lot of oomph, admittedly. The other day it had me doing 7 knots hour after hour on the way from Valencia to Galway across the centre of a tropical low, while everyone else, from Bloody Fallen to Roach's Point, was sheltering from gales. But then, proper symmetrical spinnakers are absolutely great sails. The enduring image of Jean-Luc Vandenheede winning the Golden Globe race is of Matmut running into Les Sables d'Olonne behind her big blue kite with the sponsor's name to the fore. How did Matmut's PR department organise that? VDH is even older than me. Maybe flying a proper spinnaker is an age thing. In which case, it is something which Old Man Sailing should seek to preserve for posterity, like baggy wrinkle and futtock shrouds. So, here's where I maintain that a symmetrical spinnaker scores over the asymmetric upstart. It's more versatile. You can fly it with the wind anywhere from dead astern, or even a bit more, to 10 degrees forward of the beam. That's 100 degrees of apparent wind angle. Try doing that with a cruising chute, and the main will blanket it once the winds get past the quarter. Asymmetrics on bowsprits don't fare much better. In fact, they really only come into their own when the boat is fast enough to shift the apparent wind so far forward that they never actually run at all. So much for the technical side. How about the fear factor? For that's the real issue. When it comes to sailing nightmares, the spinnaker wrap is right up there along with hitting the container, the out-of-season hurricane, lightning strikes, and piracy. And it's a legitimate fear. Once your pretty sail is wrapped a couple of times round the foresay, when you just happen to be passing a wind farm or the south coast of Jersey, or one of those trawlers that keep relentlessly and rightfully to their course, you are, without any doubt, in the deep stuff. I just looked, and there is no advice whatsoever on the internet about how to deal with a spinnaker wrap. Plenty about how to avoid it before it happens, but absolutely nothing about what to do when it does. I suppose this is because there really is nothing you can do, short of sending somebody aloft with a sharp knife. It's either that or wait till the wind drops. To prove this point, I remember one of the ASAP competitors sailing back into Falmouth with 3 metres of spinnaker still flying from his masthead. He had managed the outward trip single-handed and without incident. For the return leg, his wife shipped aboard, but flatly refused to let him go up the mast to retrieve the sail. I don't believe they have sailed together since. In fact, I'm not even sure they're still married. Anyway, to business. Here is the old man's recipe for flying a traditional spinnaker single-handed and safely. First, before you do anything else, hoist your spinnaker net. You can make this yourself. It's just 2 3-millimeter lines hoisted on a spare halyard. One line clips to the stem head fitting just after the furling gear, the other to the foot of the mast. Between these two, run 3 shorter lengths of line at intervals to form a net. Once this is up, it is impossible for anything to wrap itself around the forestay. My net has clips on one end of the horizontal lines, and I attach them as I hoist it. It makes it less prone to tangles. Rig your sheets and guys, if they aren't a permanent fixture. The sheets go to the blocks on the quarters, the guys to the blocks on the boat's widest point. If your boat is shaped like a dart and the widest point is the stern, then you will have a bowsprit and an asymmetric spinnaker, and none of this applies. On each side, the guy and the sheet terminate in a single snap shackle. Once you've got all that lot sorted, you can furl your headsail. Take the spinnaker halyard round the foresay to the lee side and clip it to the guardrail. Rig the pole on the windward side with the spinnaker guy through the down-facing jaw and pulled in front of the forestay, clipped to the leeward side of the pulpit. You'll need 2 up-hauls off the pole, one for each side, otherwise you won't be able to jibe it with the net up. Downhaul can be taken through a block in the centre of the foredeck and led back to the cockpit. Bring up the spinnaker and attach the guy and sheet. Ensure that the line for the squeezer is not tangled and kept inside everything else. The line should run through some sort of ring which can be attached to a point in the middle of the foredeck. You don't want to worry about losing it. Go back to the cockpit and pull in the guy so that the clew of the sail is dragged around to the weather side. Leave enough slack in the sheet so that the sail will not fill immediately. You don't want to be pitched off the foredeck when it suddenly inflates with a bang. Make up the pole downhaul in the cockpit. Once all is ready, attach the halyard and hoist the sail in its squeezer. Raise the squeezer and make fast the line around a foredeck cleat to stop the funnel slipping down if the wind drops. Go back to the cockpit and haul in the sheet. Adjust the guy and the pole downhaul. And off you go. Writing it all down like this makes everything sound rather complicated, which I suppose it is when compared to hoisting a cruising chute, but really it's just a matter of remembering everything and doing it in the right order, and of course practicing until you can run through the whole process in 10 minutes. One other thing to mention, particularly for single-handers, is that I have never managed to get a mechanical wind vane to steer a spinnaker. As soon as there is a puff of wind, the boat accelerates and the apparent wind angle moves forward, throwing everything out of kilter. An electronic autopilot works fine, but I would love to know how the Golden Globe guys did it. Meanwhile, a couple of things to mention about taking your spinnaker down again. Firstly, douse it as soon as the autopilot loses control. Okay, so you could do a better job steering yourself, but then how are you going to cope on the foredeck when you have to hand the ship back to the microchips and they let her broach all over the place? Wear a thick pair of gloves when hauling the squeezer down over the sail. Even with the sheet flying, there's a lot of tension on that very thin line. Oh, and by the way, I'm not proud. I pull the squeezer down when the time comes to jibe. It only takes a moment and makes the whole operation so much more manageable. Elysian. I don't like towing a dinghy. It slows you down. It gets itself in trouble. In the worst case scenario, you can end up losing it. That's why I carry the smallest, lightest, only 10 kilos, that I could find. You can deflate it and stow it in 5 minutes, so who needs to tow it? But what I witnessed 20 miles northwest of the Scilly Isles yesterday beggars belief. First, there was an alarm from the AIS, a 12-meter pleasure vessel approaching at 12 knots, so it had to be a motor yacht. Anyway, sailing yachts don't call themselves pleasure vessels. But there was something odd about the name of this one, TT Elysian. TT usually stands for Tender 2. But nobody puts an AIS transporter on their dinghy. And anyway, what kind of dinghy do you find out in the Western Approaches doing 12 knots in those big Atlantic rollers? Then I looked more closely and saw that there were in fact two little green triangles, one overlapping the other. The second one was called Elysian, another pleasure vessel. But this one was 66 meters and was going to Lorient. Sure enough, there, at the end of a very, very long line, was a small speedboat. Well, when I say small, the AIS pointed out that it was longer than Samsara, but it did look very small compared to the mothership. Was it too big to get aboard? Could the 16 crew not be bothered? Did the owner know? Can you get away with treating a £500,000 reaver that way? I've since looked online and found that Elysian is available for charter at $448,000 a week, and, let's face it, isn't that typical of the way people treat charter boats? If you happen to find yourself rafted up alongside somewhere in the sun one evening, and you get chatting over a beer, you might let them know. You'll like Galway. You don't have a choice. The lock gate only opens for 2 hours on each tide, so once you're in, there's nothing to do but drink Guinness and listen to traditional Irish music. Actually, I can think of worse ways of spending a week of gales, because that's what we did, my 16-year-old son Hugo and I. His flight out from the UK had been booked for months, carefully scheduled to get him back in time for his GCSE results, and of course, I had to make darn sure I was there in time to meet him. So I sailed straight from Falmouth, pausing only to wait out a Force 7 headwind in a protected little pool at the entrance to Port Magee Sound. In fact, I arrived early enough to stop at Inismore, the largest of the Aran Islands. There are two things you need to know about the Aran Islands: Aran sweaters and ruins. Every day the tour boats disgorge swarms of Americans and Italians and, well, tourists from everywhere. And as soon as their feet touch the ground, they split up and head off in two different directions. Half to the cycle hire shop to pedal off to the medieval fortress of Dunengus, I think that's how you pronounce it, and the other half to the Aran sweater shop. I looked round the sweater shop. After all, I wear a sweater all through the winter, and there are holes in both elbows. However, I couldn't see the beautiful and unbelievably soft woolens on display lasting much past the end of November. So, It was off to the fortress. They charged for entry, of course, and the entrance was a 20-minute walk from the fortress itself. Alternatively, there was an award-winning ice cream shop. And anyway, I'd be coming back again with Hugo, wouldn't I? For culture, I pedalled off to the nine churches. It would be easy to miss these. I managed to find two surrounded by a neat graveyard with Gaelic inscriptions, continuing long after the churches had been abandoned. But despite clattering all the way down the track to the sea, there was no sign of the other five. When I got back, feeling a little cheated, there was a minibus waiting. The driver, an obvious character in a baseball cap and a Zapata moustache, sat biding his time while his passengers milled around the ruins. So I asked him for directions to the other seven. "Ah," he says, "there are only the two." "Then why do they call them the nine churches?" "Well, that's just what they call them." I did thinking of asking why, but sometimes in the west of Ireland it doesn't do to ask too many questions. I still had 2 days before Hugo arrived and wanted to look at Samsara's hull. There was a convenient quay at the entrance to the Kinvara River, so there I was in the middle of the night poking around in the mud beside Parkmore Quay, built with money sent by the people of Canada, apparently, when suddenly there was a hello from the top. Since I might look a bit suspicious, I explained that I would be drying out in the morning and wanted to check that the keel would not be resting on a boulder or something. The pair of dog walkers, as they turned out to be, understood completely. This was their boat out there, the green one. It was pitch dark. In the morning, as I knelt in the mud with a packet of scouring pads and discovering my very expensive copper coat anti-fouling was falling off, the couple returned. They came down and looked. They were sympathetic about the state of the bottom and complimentary about Samsara's lines, and, seemingly on the strength of no more than this, invited me for dinner. Being an Englishman and not used to invitations from people I hadn't previously met, I made an excuse. And later I wondered, had I done the right thing? After all, people were different over here. They were friendlier. I called and left a message, and that evening Anne came and collected me, and I presented her with a bottle of wine that had survived 6 months in the bilges and a loaf of boat bread. And Alan returned from selling a guitar, and another couple turned up, and we had a very convivial evening. It was the same in Galway. No sooner had I met the harbour master than he whisked me off for a Guinness. Well, four, actually. Hugo arrived on schedule, and so did a whole string of Atlantic lows, one after another. Well, if you're going to get stuck somewhere, I used to recommend Dublin. Now I recommend Galway. First, there was the Guinness, which is not the same as it is in England, because they pour two-thirds of it with nitrogen and only the last third with carbon dioxide. Then there is the music. Everywhere in Galway there is music in the pubs, in the streets. Tig Coily is the famous music pub, but right outside any day you can find the Galway Street Club, a loose group of enthusiasts who play just for the love of playing, although they don't do badly out of the equally enthusiastic crowd. On the corner, you will find someone with a guitar or fiddle or just a penny whistle. Some of them barely into their teens, others old and grey and stooped and still going. I was keen that we should see a game of hurling, the peculiar Irish sport which seems to owe something to hockey, but also to basketball and tennis, with maybe a bit of rugby thrown in, and certainly the egg and spoon race. After messing up the buses, Galway has three bus stations, we took a taxi to the Gaelic Athletic Association's Pearse Stadium and saw Kinvara beat Carnmore, so narrowly as it happens, that the final minute had the entire Carnmore team crowded around the Kinvara goal, brandishing their hurleys in the hope of snatching the vital 3 points. It didn't happen, but it did give a very good impression of what the Battle of Loch Nee must have been like. This gave us such an appetite for this most exciting but unrecognised sport that we simply had to go and find a spot in the front door pub and watch Tipperary snatch the national title from Kilkenny. No wonder they wear helmets. There was a day when it stopped raining, although it didn't stop blowing, so we hired another bike from the West of Ireland Cycle Hire, stuffed it into the cargo bay with my little folding Brompton, and set off for the Burren. This is a huge and rocky chunk of landscape on the south side of Galway Bay, which might look pretty barren, but in fact is home to 70% of Ireland's collection of wildflowers. If you're cycling, be warned, it does go up and down a lot. But we stopped at St. Fachin's Holy Well and dropped a coin in for the GCSE results. We could have taken the old bog road, but there was a small sign saying, "This road is subject to flooding." Well, it would be, wouldn't it? Later, over lunch and more Guinness at Cassidy's Bar, we discovered that the old bog road runs along the bottom of what is Europe's largest disappearing lake. That is to say, that it's 5 metres deep when the rain finally stops, and then takes a couple of days to drain away through underground caves and swallow holes before the weather turns soft again. Cycling the Burren was a grand day, as they say over here, apart from one tiny detail. Our bus back to Galway was due at 4:50. By 5:20, the locals who were waiting scattered up and down the pavement, sitting in doorways, poking at their phones, assured us that it would be here directly. Sure, it's a bit late sometimes. After 3/4 of an hour, when it still hadn't turned up, Hugo and I repaired to the pub opposite, whereupon the bus arrived. The driver, the same one who had taken us on the outward trip, appeared resolutely unconcerned. "Sure, and it's been busy today," was all he offered. We were too late to get the bike back, but the guy at the hire shop let us off. He was a Londoner, but London-Irish, so I suppose that counts. In the end, we did get the sail. There was a 48-hour gap in the weather towards the end of the week, enough to dash over to Kinvara, about 7 miles, take the tide up to the village, and go to the pub. The pilot book says, "The passage should be undertaken with great care and continuous use of the echo sounder." We crept in, just about maintaining steerage way, the tide doing most of the work, and our noses pressed to our phone screens and the Navionics app. Of course, after a couple of pints in the Pier Hotel, we went a lot faster. But then Hugo was driving and exhibiting all the resilience of youth. I missed him when he left. Then Con Brosnan turned up from Dublin, half a day late and complaining about the traffic. Con is another rival owner, but his boat seems to have taken root in the yard in Gibraltar. So it was back to Murphy's Bar, and then walking along the pontoon and feeling that Ireland had got the social juices flowing, I stopped in my tracks at the sight of the biggest, most solid, most classically beautiful boat you can imagine. This was called, well, I don't even try to pronounce this one. It's a Scandinavian name beginning with F. A 1936 Norwegian pilot boat, in fact, and not a winch in sight. Fabulous woodwork, a 10-foot clinker dinghy stowed upright on deck. Dead eyes? And yet, there was an enormous Rockner anchor, a full-sized Raymarine plotter in the cockpit, modernity where it mattered, tradition where it belonged. Bjorna Berg and Clara Emfrehorse met in a boatyard. He was the mechanic and she was the shipwright. And their boat, beginning with F, started life in 1936 as a pilot boat for the island of the same name, which I won't pronounce, and carried on in service until 1968. Bjorna bought her in 2005, and now they've cruised to the Shetlands, the Faroes, Iceland, Greenland, Nova Scotia, and all the way down the coasts of Canada and the USA to the West Indies. But the Caribbean was not a success. The boat is 12 metres by 4.6 beam, would you believe? And the woodwork absorbed every joule of heat and promptly released it into the already sweltering cabin. The two Norse people, more used to thick sweaters and two heaters for half the year, just couldn't cope with all this, so they headed north again. I asked where they were going after Galway, but they simply had no idea. Nor did they know where they were going to spend the winter. "We'll see," said Bjornar. "For now, we like it here." He had a good point. I just want to take a moment to tell everybody that the Utility Warehouse Cashback Card now works with the Apple Pay app. Now, this means that when you go shopping, you can pay with your phone, the money comes off your cashback card, and then the shop where you bought whatever it was will give you a percentage of that purchase price, send it to Utility Warehouse, who will then deduct it from your bill. And obviously, you're not just buying one thing a month, you're buying lots of things. And if you buy them all with your phone on Apple Pay and on the cashback card, you end up getting an awful lot of money off your bill. I mean, in our household, we're always getting at least £30 a month off the bill. The month I bought the laptop, I think it was about £90. You don't get that kind of money off your household bills any other way. If you'd like one of these cards, do let me know. Just give me an email, john@oldmansailing.com, and I'll show you how it works. Meanwhile, I'm going to include something here that is strictly not about sailing. But my new book, Faster, Louder, Riskier, Sexier, is becoming a bit of a success. And people tell me it is the best thing I've ever written. So if you read any of the other books and you like them, this one is better. It took 7 long years to write it. Have a look online and read about it, because it's all explained there. I won't go into it, but I will read you one extract. This goes back to the days when I was about 18 or 19, and I worked on a farm. I earned £12.19 and 6 pence a week at a time when a gallon of petrol cost 2 and 6, and an evening's dinner and dancing at Francois in Sloane Square would set you back £5. Of course, this being the 60s, the weekend didn't start until midday on Saturday. One Saturday in particular deserves to be remembered. I was anxious to get away, see Chapter 6, Love, when the farmer informed me that I would spend the morning loading straw. The lorry would arrive shortly. All I had to do was help the driver. Pretty simple. I had loaded plenty of straw bales by this time, pitching them up onto the trailer with an old-fashioned pitchfork. A bit of muscle, but mostly technique and timing. The lorry duly arrived at mid-morning, and I directed the driver as he backed up to the haystack. Then he climbed down and looked at me, and I looked at him. They were just the two of us. "Okay," I said, "I'll pitch and you stack." And he said, "What?" I explained, but his expression still indicated that as far as he was concerned, I might as well have been speaking Serbo-Croat. I might indeed have been speaking a foreign language, because it turned out that A, the driver had never carried a load of straw before. B, he had never collected any kind of load from a farm before, not straw bales, not sacks of grain, never delivered bags of fertilizer. C, actually, he had never driven a lorry before. He was a bus driver. Also, there was some urgency, because the reason he was driving a lorry today was in order to earn a bit of extra money, because D, at 3 o'clock, he was getting married. What with all this discussion, it was now getting on for 11. He said, "Can't you load if I pitch?" I'd never done that before. Of course, I'd seen it done. The trick was to begin at the outside and prop the ends of the bales on the raised edges of the lorry bed. That made them lean inwards. The secret was to have all the outside bales leaning inwards right up to the top of the stack, and then the weight of the top layer would lock everything in place, like the box in a game of Jenga. At least, I think that was the idea. They hadn't invented Jenga, but as I say, I've never done it myself. So we started work. He pitched while I stacked. And of course, we chatted as we worked. He told me all about his fiancée and the wedding. I think the honeymoon was going to be in Great Yarmouth or somewhere like that. In the light of what happened an hour later, it's hardly surprising that I don't remember the details. I do remember him telling me that he had it all worked out. As long as he left by 12:30, he would just have time to dump the lorry at the haulage depot, rush home for a quick change, and be at the church for 3 o'clock. I stacked as fast as I could. I didn't want him to be late. He pitched as fast as he could. He said it was hard work. He said he'd stick to driving a bus. We got it all done in time. I laid the top layer to hold it all together. He threw up a rope. We lashed it down nice and tight with proper wagoner's hitches. We shook hands. I wished him luck for the future, and he climbed up into the cab, fired up the big diesel, and lurched out of the farm gate. I say lurched because years of heavy machinery driving in and out of the farm had opened up a large pothole on one side of the gateway. When it got too bad, we put a barrow load of hardcore into it and drove a tractor backwards and forwards to tamp it down. But it was a while since we'd done that, and as the lorry's near side back wheels dropped into the hole, the entire chassis dipped to the left. Now, you can tie a load of straw bales onto a flatbed lorry very securely. After all, you can get a good bit of purchase with a wagoner's hitch, the way I'd learned to tie them as a competent farm worker, even if I was only worth £12.19 a week. However, the thing to remember about small bales is that not all of them will be secured by the rope. Some of them will be in the gaps between it. And if the weight of the top layer is not sufficient to lock them in place, especially if the ends of the bottom layer are not quite high enough because they're on a lorry and not a farm trailer, or maybe if the whole structure is fundamentally unstable because it has been stacked by somebody who is doing it for the first time and whose entire experience is based on seeing somebody else do it, when that happens, the laws of physics come into play. In this case, the principles of kinetic energy, as derived from the tilting and motion of the lorry chassis when the near side wheels dropped into the hole. The weight of the offside bales duly shifted onto those in the middle, and the resulting momentum was in turn transferred to those on the near side. Fortunately, some of those were secured by the stout rope and my masterful wagoner's hitches. Unfortunately, others were not. And once some of the near-side bales fell out, those previously constrained by the rope were able to ooze into the gap left behind. I say ooze, which is an odd word to use when describing something as dry as straw, but it seemed to me that I was watching the unfolding disaster in slow motion. One after another, the bales found their way around the ropes, and as they did so, began to bend, which is something you should never allow a small bale to do, at least not until you want to break it open and spread the straw in your stable or strawberry field or wherever. In this instance, it spread all over the road. One by one, they toppled. Some bursting as they fell, others crashing onto the tarmac and going off like big golden bombs. The lorry stopped with another lurch, which only helped to add impetus to the avalanche. The lorry driver, bus driver, bridegroom, jumped down from the cab and took in the scene with an expression which I don't think I ought to attempt to describe, because at my age I should try and avoid undue excitement. But it was while we were both standing there and watching the apparently never-ending cascade that the farmer arrived in his little grey Renault 4. He stopped and got out. He nodded to the lorry driver, bus driver, bridegroom. He handed me my pay packet. He said, "Right, 12:30, you can go off for the weekend now." But I began. I gestured, mumbling, at the pile of loose straw which was now blocking the whole road. "It's out of the farm gate," said the farmer. "It's not your problem. It's not mine either. In you get." And with a further nod to my new friend, the driver, he drove me back to the home farm to pick up my bicycle, which, thanks to the Renault 4's legendary suspension, we were able to do without even noticing the pothole. I collected the bike and returned to my caravan, where I was able to change back into my groovy 1960s gear, jump into my Mini, and head back to London where I belonged. But I have spent the rest of my life wondering what happened. How did the bus driver get all that loose straw cleared up? He couldn't get it back on the lorry. How long did it take? He was due at the church at 3 o'clock. Did he miss the wedding altogether? Did the honeymoon in Great Yarmouth never happen? Have I ruined somebody's life just because I learned to tie a wagoner's hitch? The Scilly Isles. There is no closer bond than the one between the single-handed sailor and his boat. Until he rows ashore, that is, then he wants to be joined at the hip to his dinghy. Mine was on the beach of the Goo, the smallest and least populated island of the Scilly Isles, that charming archipelago off the southwest tip of England. To say the Goo is small is to say that it measures half a mile by less than a quarter. To say that it is the least populated is also accurate. It has two houses. One is empty, and the other is home to a man called Alan, and thank heavens for that. Mind you, the Goo is only an island at high tide. The rest of the time it is joined to its much larger neighbour, St. Agnes, by a narrow sandbar. This means that it is easy to think of them as one island. That is a mistake. I went to look at the Goo and its prehistoric standing stone and two peculiar houses with the curved roofs so that they don't blow off, and I planned to go and look at St. Agnes, which is twice the size and with a population of more than 80. This means that I left the dinghy on the Goo side. I did pull it up well above the tide line and tied it to a rock, with three or four other rocks holding down the first rock, and then another couple in the dinghy itself to stop it flying away. Believe me, that dinghy wasn't going anywhere. And so, without a care in the world, I set off for the Old Man of Goo and Obadiah's Barrow, where they found a skeleton buried in a sitting position surrounded by a dozen urns full of human remains. St. Agnes was much more cheerful. For a start, it had the Troy Town Maze. Now, I don't know what sort of image this conjures for you, but surely something involving theme parks or stately homes. Certainly a major visitor attraction. According to the guidebook, it was laid out by a lighthouse keeper in 1729, adding to a much larger maze. That one may have had Viking connections, because similar designs have been found in Sweden. However, now we'll never know, because in the early 2000s, a well-intentioned visitor took it upon themselves to rebuild the maze with new stones from the beach. This completely thwarted the archaeologists' attempts to date it. Actually, when you see it, you can't blame the helpful visitor. This has to be the most unimpressive maze ever to make it into a guidebook, even if walking around it is said to promote well-being. Ha! See below. Still, if I hadn't gone looking for the maze, I would never have found Troy Town Farm ice cream, which has to be absolutely the best anywhere, made from milk from Scilly's only dairy herd, 11 cows. So, what with one thing and another, it was a contented old man who dawdled back, flicking blackberries and wondering if you could make crumble with cooking oil instead of butter. That was why it was quite late by the time I returned to the sandbar and the dinghy. Except the sandbar wasn't there anymore. Now there was only a maelstrom of churning white water as the spring tide raced between the islands at upwards of 4 knots. As the guidebook says helpfully, it is dangerous to attempt the crossing at such times. Over on the other side, the water was lapping at my dinghy. Instantly, the single-hander's primal urge kicked in. Surely, if I went to rescue it now, before the tide came up any higher, I bet I could walk across. It would only be knee-deep, perhaps thigh-deep. I didn't mind getting my shorts wet, even if it was waist-deep. There must be some medical term for this instinctive rejection of all common sense. Fortunately, the prospect of drowning acted as an antidote, or rather, drowning and being described in the local paper as a pensioner, not to mention the lifeboat coxswain's comments about weekend sailors. With considerable effort, I hauled myself back from the brink and made for the pub. If in doubt, make for the pub. Simon, the landlord, listened sympathetically, as if he had heard this story before, which he had many times. He and Angela had been corporate IT geeks until they sailed here in their 35-footer 4 years ago and found the Turk's Head looking for new owners. Simon put all the other customers on hold while he searched for a phone number for Alan. I hoped Alan would be home. Of course he was home. Where else could he go at high tide? He promised he would have a look. After that, there was really nothing for me to do but sit in the pub for the next 4 hours while the tide finished coming in and started going out. So I had a beer, and then another one. That took 20 minutes. Then Simon showed me all the artifacts he had brought up from wrecks around the island. Can you imagine an entire cargo of bells, the sort that summoned the servants in Victorian households? After that, it seemed to be time for another beer, and, considering the way the evening was panning out, I had better have dinner, and was joined by a couple from Devon who were similarly marooned. The Salonian, the Scilly Isles ferry from Penzance, had suffered double engine failure. People were having to bunk up where they could. As for me, I rushed back to reclaim my dinghy as soon as I could, without drowning, that is. Shame. Had I obeyed my usual instinct and stayed in the pub until chucking out time, I would have been there to join the celebrations at the safe arrival of Safe Arrival, another Rival 32, like Samsara. Her crew of 3 lads from Falmouth had sailed straight from Greenland, 16 days, at the end of a 4-month climbing cruise. Angela broke out the rum. These guys deserved it. They had been by far the most smallest boat in those northern waters, and almost all the others had been steel and aluminium and kitted out for expedition sailing. Safe Arrival's only modification were a solid spray hood and a couple of windsurfer masts for pushing the bergy bits out of the way. But then, the cove at St. Agnes seemed to be a gathering place for all sorts of interesting boats. There was an ancient lugger with a bumpkin sticking out the back, which must have been half the length of the rest of the boat at least. They hung the ensign off the end of it with the lead weight to hold it down. Then there was the brand new Rustler 57 I mentioned in the experts post. But I wasn't in their league. However, I had already made a friend of the Frenchman in the peculiar catamaran with a mast on each hull. I had anchored rather too close to him in Tresco, and then drew even closer as I went to move the next morning. "Don't worry, I am here," he said as he stood by to fend me off. Now he was here again. And whatever you think of big cats, his boat was something really special. Mark had been around multi-hulls all his life, building them, designing them, sailing them. They'd all been called Kalim ever since his first, when he sailed the Atlantic as a young man to sit at the feet of his heroes Dick Newick and Mike Birch. In the end, he spent most of his life out there refining multi-hull design. Now, with Marielle, he has his ultimate boat, as he put it, his old man's boat. Simple, spacious, light and fast. Designed for sailing in the tropics, and actually very beautiful. How fast would she go with her two wing sails? At 15 metres overall, he designed her for a top speed of 24 knots. But that's not important. What matters is the average, and the latest Kalim is designed for daily runs of 200 miles, which means the Galapagos to the Marquesas is not much over 2 weeks. While the crew relax on a park bench. Yes, they have a park bench at the back of the cockpit in the sun. If you fancy a Kalim yourself, you're out of luck. For the first time, Mark's design is not for sale. As he said, as soon as you start selling your ideas, you have people wanting to know where they can put a second head or a washing machine. I am done with all that. He doesn't even have an outboard. Instead, a slender rowing skiff he designed himself. Mark likes rowing, doing it properly with crossed hands. The Sillies were always going to be full of interest, if only because of the anticipation. I've been trying to get here for 40 years. The trouble was that the pilot books make the island sound so terrifying that I ended up sitting in Falmouth or Penzance listening to shipping forecasts and biting my nails. Writers of pilot books love this sort of thing. Even Reeds, not given to hyperbole, says, "The Isles of Scilly are exposed to Atlantic swell and wind. Weather can be unpredictable and fast-changing. Thorough planning and sensible precautions, especially with regard to anchorage and ground tackle, are recommended. Boats have been known to drag on fine sand." There follows a whole column of dangers to avoid. The first time I came here was on the old Salonian in 1965 as a 16-year-old biology student on a field trip. Mostly I remember the New Inn on Tresco, where I ordered my first pint of beer. My father would only buy me halves, saying that no gentleman would be seen with a pint. We stayed in a bothy and were served fiery curries by an old sailor who dropped ash into the pot from the capstan full strength glued to his lower lip. Obviously, I had to go back to the New Inn. But it's all changed now. The old bar was demolished in 1997. Conveniently, just as a German cargo ship on autopilot hit the rocks off Newfoundland Point while the crew were asleep. It was loaded with wood, and in the best traditions of the Scilly Isles, the islanders helped themselves. The new extended and wood-panelled bar looks lovely. Don't criticise. As the Reverend John Troutbeck, 18th century vicar of St. Mary's, put it, "We pray thee, Lord, not that wrecks should happen, but that if any wrecks should happen, thou wilt guide them into the Scilly Isles for the benefit of the inhabitants." Shipwrecks and the Scilly Isles go together like crab and mayonnaise. In the Abbey Gardens you can find a museum of figureheads retrieved from the sea, and, of course, it was the Scillies where Admiral Sir Cloudesley Shovel's fleet piled up in 1707, prompting the race to find a way of determining longitude. As a 16-year-old, I couldn't see the point in spending good beer money looking at exotic plants in museums, but I do remember longingly looking across New Grimsby Sound and wishing I had a boat, for there was Briar, as tantalising as a tropic isle on the other side of a sparkling lagoon. Actually, Briar is well worth visiting anyway, if only for the smallest museum in Britain. It's probably the smallest museum in the world. It's the only phone box and is dedicated entirely to the 1989 film When the Whales Came. This is based on the book by Michael Merpurgo. The best part of the story is that, having signed Paul Scofield and Helen Mirren for the leads, the director needed a child to play the central character. After scouring the mainland stage schools, he found her on St. Agnes. And all the island people had been recruited as extras, simpler than trying to find accommodation for outsiders. One of those extras was 8-year-old Helen Pierce. All she had to do was play herself, a half-wild nymph of the sea and the sand, and the critics loved her. Over on the other side was Hell Bay, and the hotel, the Hell Bay Hotel. I mean, you just have to go and have a beer in somewhere called the Hell Bay Hotel. It's not actually in Hell Bay as such. As the barman explained, there wouldn't be much left standing after the winter gales if it was, and the guests didn't look the type to rough it. In my shorts and Crocs, I took my beer out onto the terrace. So, out of Scilly's 5 inhabited islands, that left only St. Martin's and St. Mary's. I wasn't going to start on the 50 uninhabited ones. I got lost on St. Martin's, trying to work out the difference between Higher Town, Middle Town, and Lower Town. Not to mention Lower Town Quay, and Higher Town New Quay, and Higher Town Old Quay. Signposts would have helped. St. Mary's has lots of signposts. It needs them, because the typical St. Mary's visitors are devoted couples of a certain age who walk slowly from one commemorative bench to the next, where they sit down once more to admire a slightly different view. Maybe that was why the 1970s Prime Minister Harold Wilson liked it so much. You can imagine him sitting there puffing his pipe with Mary beside him, making up her poems. He's buried in the churchyard now, amongst all the poor dead sailors.